Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're about to listen to an interview which our socios enjoyed in full 12 months ago. If you'd like to listen to these exclusive monthly big interviews on the day that they're released, it's time to join us. That means supporting us. It means the price of a pint per month. Go to Patreon, patreon.com/GrahamHunter. Go now, join and become a socio. That means you'll get that extra big interview every month. And you'll also unlock our entire archive straight away, all for £2.99 a month. It's the best deal in town, baby. And we need you.
Whenever I watched David Weir, what shone out was that he was from an older school of Scottish football because he was bright. He read games terrifically. He made sure that his career was long, not simply because he ate, what was Gordon Strachan's recipe? Bananas, porridge and honey and nettles? No. David Weir didn't simply stretch and yoga his way to a long career. It was his brain. But he was also ferociously competitive. And in my eyes, it was a picture book story, a boy's own story. To be, in his own words, not good enough for professional football at age 18. To go to the United States, to land there in the kind of circumstances which would have made an extra plot for the writers of Gregory's Girl or That Sinking Feeling or Local Hero. To survive that, to thrive, to become the elite of American college soccer, come back, knock on the door of his local club, be picked, graduate to winning trophies in Scotland, make a huge career in England with Everton, a mighty club with a proud support, and to tell us, to be able to tell us about characters like Duncan Ferguson, Tommy Gravesen, Kev Kilbane, Walter Smith, to tell us what it was like to play against Robbie Keane or Freddie Kanute, the great strikers of that Premier League era. David Weir is as good a storyteller as he was a match reader. But then to end up at the club he always supported and to go to a European final with them, well, what that makes is a really good story. We went to his home, we sat down with him, he relaxed and he told us all about it. Here it is. Now, you took quite an unusual route to become a Falkirk player, which was, well, it's your story, tell it. How the hell did you end up in America as a youngster? And yeah, what happened?
By default, really. I think I probably wasn't good enough. You know, majority of Scottish kids growing up wanting to be professional footballers, wanting to play for,
damn tootin',
you know, Rangers, Celtic, Aberdeen, wherever, you know, whatever your sort of fancy was. And I grew up hoping to be a footballer, and then as I got to 16, 17, probably realising that I wasn't going to be quite good enough, so didn't really have an idea what I wanted to do. Stayed on at school, still keen on education, still enjoyed school life, and playing for Scotland schoolboys under 18s, which the 15s and 16s were always the best teams. Everybody was still at school and all the best players were in those teams. The 18s was less so, but was still competitive and still a good level, and we played in England against all the English counties. at that tournament, which was in Skegness, staying at the Butlins camp, which was a very good experience with a bunch of Scottish lads.
My red coat days. Yeah. Very good.
Played a few games and got scouted by an American university. So within the space of a week, the coach from the university had been up to my house in Falkirk, met my mum and dad, and I told them that I wanted to go to America.
Whoa. We just need to put the, what do they call it on TV, the super slow-mo on this. So you're at Butlins. Now, what's that all? Do we know any of your contemporaries?
I'm trying to think who was in the team. John O'Neill, who had a good career in Scotland. I don't know the lads.
Rather than famous names, they were of a good level, eh?
Yeah, they were good level, and they're all playing at clubs or in and around clubs, you know, so they were good footballers.
This was a fixture that when I was growing up, well, I'm a different age from you, yeah, but this was a gigantic fixture. Yeah. Scotland schoolboys against England schoolboys, not the counties, at Wembley was a sellout game, one of the few, you know, the five, six games you saw live in the year. It was a massive thing to play for Scottish schoolboys.
It was, particularly at 15s, 16s, but then the majority of the best players, as you know, leave, become full-time and go, you know, S-forms as it was at the time, or scholarships as it is now. So the 18s were the players that were still in school, still sort of trying to educate themselves. So the level wasn't quite as good, but it was still competitive and still a great experience.
And the Butlins thing was just like cheap accommodation.
Exactly, yeah. All the teams were there. So I think we played Greater London, maybe Nottinghamshire, maybe Manchester. You know, we played probably the better teams. So it was Scotland under-18s against these regions in England, and everyone was based at this camp.
Deadly serious, bed by 10, macrobiotic diet.
I'm not sure it was quite that serious.
There's a little bit of larking about.
There was a bit, yeah. But it was good fun. It was, you know, thinking back, I've actually still got a ball. I was player of the tournament or whatever, or player of our team. Still got the ball, and all the lads have signed it with a little message on it.
Fabulous.
So it's always nice to look back at things like that.
So, obviously, if you're playing football in Skegness, I mean, it's obvious now looking back, there's going to be an American university there scouting you. So, first of all, how did you hear about this?
Well, the coach basically spoke to our coach and said, you know, we're like a couple of these lads, would they be interested? And then asked me, would you be interested? And I was like, 100%.
Yeah, you bet your bottom dollar.
What's the next step? So they said, well, we're in the UK for a few days. It was actually an English coach and an American coach. We're in the UK for a few days. Let us come up, speak to your mum and dad, and, you know, hopefully we can get this sorted. So they basically came up, you know, within the week, turned up on the front door, my mum and dad, and offered me this opportunity to go to America on a 4-year scholarship, paid for, which was great, you know. Whoa. Because it can be an expensive experience. So a full scholarship and travelling to a place called Evansville, Indiana, which had
Centre of the universe,
exactly that, which I'd never heard of, and involved, bearing in mind I'd never been abroad at this time, I'd never been in an aeroplane, never been abroad.
But there's still no internet, so you didn't go to Google?
No, not at all. You know, it was just a massive step into the unknown, but I just knew, me being me, I knew it was the right thing, and I just had a...
How?
You know, my instinct told me this is
just
what
something innate.
Yeah.
Like, just, I can handle this, or it'll be right for me, or...
Yeah. I just wanted to do it. It just seemed like football was kind of in the background, not in the background, but it was there, but it wasn't going to be a career. Education was there, but I hadn't really found anything that was perfect. I was talking about going to a couple of universities in England, but wasn't sure. And then this just came right in the middle, and I thought, this ticks all the boxes.
Now, your parents have been very, very, very important in your life. But how do they greet this news? And how do they talk to their son about the idea?
I think they were shocked, genuinely shocked. You know, they probably didn't, you know, as I didn't either, realise the implications of it. You know, within a couple of months, my dad and mum were driving me down to Prestwick Airport to drop me off to go to America. My dad, I'll never forget, my dad was in tears, dropped me off, and I'm like, what's up, man? What's the problem here?
It hadn't registered to you that the emotion that might cause in them.
And the significance of that, and my dad, traditional Scottish father, you know, that wasn't a normal situation for him.
No, but, you know, I don't want to be too romantic, but the idea about sending off the young talented ones to Australia or America wasn't that far back in his memory that he might have been thinking, geez, I wonder if David's going to come back, whether he'll stay over there. Is this a change in our family life forever?
Definitely. My dad was, you know, of the age where, as you say, he's gone away and being potentially being in the army and being conscripted and being, you know, involved in that sort of thing. So it was similar in terms of leaving home, leaving your little village or your little place and, you know, experience the big bad world, obviously.
But he backed you.
He did.
Do you know?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Never at once did they say, we don't think you should do this, or, you know, I'm not really sure about this. They did back my judgment, maybe. Glad to get rid of me at that stage.
What kind of place was Indiana then? The year we're talking about, we need to be clearer about.
I think 88, I'd have been 18 going over, so that would have been 88. And to get there at the time, so Evansville, Indiana, had to fly to New York. So Prestwick to New York, New York to Detroit, I'll never forget, Detroit to St. Louis. They picked up in St. Louis and it was a 3-hour drive to Evansville by two lads who were on the team.
So and you've never been abroad before, and you've got to do 1, 2, 3, 4 airports, and then do a 3-hour drive to get to the place.
Well, it should have been 3 airports, but it was actually 4 airports because I got to New York, and as I said, my first flight, and I thought I had to get my bags after every flight. So I was either LaGuardia or JFK, and I'm in there, I'm waiting on my bags, and I actually ended up with one of my bags. I don't know how. And I said to the lady, I've not got my other bags. And she said, you don't need your bags. Your bags will go all the way.
If you've never travelled before, I completely understand that.
So I missed my flight. And I was saying, I've missed my flight. This is what's happened. And the lady at the, whichever airline it was at the time, says, you missed your flight. I'm really sorry.
Tough luck. No.
But obviously saw my panic softened and said, look, there's a flight leaves from LaGuardia or JFK, whichever one it is, in 2 hours.
She didn't say you should get your ship across the Big Apple and you might just get on that flight.
Yeah. So she sorted the flight for me.
But what's your next step? How did you get across the city?
Just had to jump in the cab. Well, one of my bags to get to the airport.
And you've got the dollars. I love
must
this.
Must have had, yeah.
This is Scottishness. We whatever happens to us, we survive, we find a solution.
Way, yeah. Well, I was like, so I got this cab across New York, and it was like the stereotypical Scotsman abroad, you know, driving through New York, watching the lads playing basketball on the courts as you're driving through. And
but it is a really stunning sight, that first time you see it at that age. It's eye-opening, and I still find it magical now.
Yeah, same. And it was part of the journey, as it turned out, you know, and part of the story, and probably shows my naivety as well, going out there and, you know, where I was at the time, but looking back, you know, got the flight, got the connection, turned up in St. Louis, obviously off a different flight as well because I'd missed the other flight. So the lads that were looking for me...
People that are listening need to realise there's no mobile phones, so you can't be communicating with themselves. I'll see you, lol, missed my flight, lol, see you in 6 hours.
So I turn up in this, get off this flight, turn up in this airport, walking through St. Louis Airport, didn't even know who was meant to be meeting. I knew their names, but I'd never seen them or met them or anything before. So we just bumped into this lad who became and still is a good friend of mine, a great friend of mine. You know, Brian, an Irish lad, says, are you David? I says, yeah. He says, come with us. But I didn't actually probably think of the gravity, you know, what was going on and where I was and if I missed the flight or if I didn't meet the people, how I was going to get out of it. You just kind of plough on and it's all seemed to fall into place.
Sensational. Meant to be. And Indiana is very different from the Big Apple with the basketball courts and the yellow cabs and the high buildings. Because it's a sort of very troubled past. Yeah. It's a difficult place. How quickly did that jacket fit around your shoulders? Getting used to...
Difficult. Mm. Difficult, first of all, temperature, heat, you know, all that goes with that. Jumping into the humidity and the heat that's, you know, is Indiana summer. That was a real shock to the system. You know, going in, landing, straight away pretty much into the football environment, trying to train and play and be involved in, you know, circumstances that were so radically different to what I was used to, plus taking into account the culture and, you know, all the other changes that were going on as well. So that was a real shock, but luckily enough, you know, surrounded by people who looked after me, really, and made it easier for me to settle in.
Yeah, looked after you is one thing, but did they understand you?
Well, fortunately, there was the Irish lad who'd picked me up, Ian O'Brien, he really helped me settle in. He was obviously a Celt to... by nature, so he kind of understood where I was coming from, took me under his wing and helped me. And there was a couple of English lads who'd gone at the same time as me and one who was a year ahead, who's actually working at Brighton now, his first team coach, Paul Nevin. So there's I was really lucky, again, you know, going into an environment where I had people
You must have been encountering Americans because, you know, I almost have like upper class English diction. I'm very easy to understand. You've got to say something 17 times in most part of America, don't you? And I'm not speaking quickly, I'm using normal words, and they just look at you blankly.
Yeah, and that was definitely the case at the start. It was very much, you know, I had to just completely change the way I was speaking, completely change the way I was talking, slow everything down, you know, use the right words, and, you know, and actually just to be able to communicate, because it was a different language, completely different.
It's a good lesson in communication.
Yeah.
For somebody who's going to go on to be communicating with groups now of people of a different age, from a different background, different maturity. It teaches you a little bit about words and how to use them and when to slice into messages and make them short and easy and comprehensible.
Exactly. And just the culture that you know, for people who are so similar in terms of, you know, they speak the same language, they're sort of similarly minded, but just the differences, you know, in terms of culture and what they think. And what we think, and you know, I was used to.
So you're ingesting litres of Gatorade or water to cope with the dehydration and whatever. Luckily, it was a slow-paced league, and you were playing at the back. You didn't have to. Wait! I've got a trivia question. Who is currently the all-time leading scorer in a single season for Evansville University? Let's name him.
David Weir.
It's you.
Yeah. Well, as you said, started as a defender, and played the majority of my first season as a defender, and then we had an injury to a lad who was the top scorer in the country at the time, who was a very good player. He was a senior, I was a freshman, so the first year he got injured, which was a disaster for the team. So the coach had, you know, the idea of putting me up front, and for the rest of my time in Evansville I was a striker. So I went from going out as a centre back, recruited as a centre back, to play as a centre back, to all of a sudden becoming the striker. And, you know, it was, surprisingly enough, I was really successful.
How did you take to it? I mean, your record says you took to it, but what did you do?
To be honest, I found it really easy, and I really enjoyed it. I think, you know, with hindsight as well, with your kids, or if you're teaching anyone to, or try to persuade anyone to be a football player, you tell them to be a centre forward.
Easiest job in the world.
Oh yeah.
Get out of here.
That's where you want to play, and I loved it. I enjoyed, you know, being the focal point. I was never quick, never have been. There was never any debate about that, but I was always capable of playing. And
it's a really good feeling scoring, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the best feeling. It's the best feeling. And I was actually okay at it. And, you know, technology wasn't great at that time, but I've still got one video of a sort of highlight tape of my time in America. One season in particular when we got to the Final Four and, you know, we did really well, and there's a sort of collaboration of all the goals throughout the season. So a couple of mine made it on there, and just, you know, that'll be 30 years ago now probably, and the memories that you kind of get, and the goals that you scored, you know, are still in the memory bank there somewhere.
You say Final Four, you don't mean Final Four of America.
Yeah, it was. For a small school, you know, Evansville, Indiana's, you know, I don't know what the equivalent over here is, but to get to the Final Four and actually compete, I think it was Rutgers, which is Alexi Lalas was playing, UCLA, I think, which would have been sort of Brad Friedel, Joe Max Moore, that, those type of lads, and I think it was, I might get this wrong, North Carolina or NC State or something like that. So they were real top level schools, and then
funded better, magnets for attracting talent, much bigger schools than Evansville. No,
yeah, definitely. And then we were, you know, we'd done well that season, had been ranked number one for a lot of the season as well. So, you know, done well, but going into that Final Four was a big achievement, but unfortunately, that's where it ended. We lost to Rutgers in the semi-final. And
had it been today, you'd have graduated straight into MLS, and you'd be you'd be Toronto, or you'd be Seattle, or you'd be LA, or whatever. Was there a thought about building a life there?
There was, and as you said, if there was an outdoor league at the time, I probably would have.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually played in the Senior Bowl, which is
the elite
of the draft now. Yeah. I played in the Senior Bowl, but it was an indoor league. So we had a week in Baltimore, sort of, you know, going through the testings and playing in the games for this indoor league, which was never going to suit me.
Because?
Just because I don't think it suited my game at the time, and the smaller, quicker players seemed to be the ones that were more suited to that type of game. So it never really worked. It never really was going to work. But I had a good time in Baltimore and got to know that a little bit, which was nice. And
there's a mysterious little sphinx-like smile on your face there, which
just you always the thing about those days, and as you got older in America, you just when you travelled, like we travelled with Evansville all over. We went to San Francisco, we went to Colorado Springs, we went to Portland, Oregon. You know, and when you go, and you know, it came back to later in my career, you get to experience these places, you get to get out and about. And I don't mean party and going nuts, but just actually seeing them and experiencing them and getting a feel for them.
It's not airport, hotel, yeah, hotel, airport.
Yeah, which a lot of the time, professional football, it can be.
All the time. You probably, because you listen in, you've told us you're generous enough to share that. And Peter Beardsley was one of our guests. He talked about Vancouver Whitecaps didn't have the budget for a big en masse movement across the country. So they'd all set off on different paths and arrive at games at different times, and not everybody would make it, and sometimes the strips wouldn't make it. I take it that it was not, or was it the same?
It was well organised in terms of, you know, we'd have long bus journeys, and I mean long bus journeys. We'd travel to Wisconsin, we'd have 12 hours on the bus, you know, so it'd be coolers full of Diet Coke, and, you know, you'd be stopping at McDonald's for your lunch and, you know, Burger King for your dinner, and you know, getting to the hotel late at night, and then playing two games. Games in 2 days. You do, yeah. So, but
your legs must have been absolutely just stiff as boards.
You never, you know, nowadays lads need second day recoveries, 3 day, you know, whatever it is, and we play two games back to back, and there'd be very few changes, and you know, if you got injured, it was usually a kick. It was never a
muscle pulling
up or anything like that. No, so I think when you start to question some of the methods today, I think you remember what you used to be able to do, and you know, I think there's maybe a balance somewhere in between.
Is there a possibility that we refine athletes and fine tune them so much now to make them a higher level performance that they're maybe less durable?
I think there is. I think, and you know, the mentality of, you know, if you tell people often enough you need this and you need that, then I think invariably they'll start to believe you. But we would play back-to-back games in the heat and in the temperatures, and then, you know, in the off-season we would drive from Evansville, we'd drive to St. Louis, so get up, drive to St. Louis, 3 hours in a car, jump out of the car, play a game and drive 3 hours back, because that was the nearest game that we could get that was of a decent level. So
just to keep you ticking over for fun or whatever,
just another game, yeah. So it's just, I think there's, you know, definitely obviously you've got to look after yourself and the sports science and the methodology that's available, everyone's got to be utilised, but I think there is a balance in terms of athletes actually pushing themselves and what you are capable of.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promote for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Outside of football, what did America do to you, do for you?
It made me grow up. I think that was the biggest thing. It made me realise, you know, that there was a big wide world out there. I was fortunate in that Evansville had a massive international community of students, so it was a hub of international students coming to the States. There was, you know, lads from Japan, there was lads from Tanzania, there was lads from Malaysia, you know, Ireland, England, you know, obviously the Germany, the European countries as well, but it was just a mass mix of cultures and people, and obviously great American people as well. So just the exposure you get to, you know, the people and cultures and experiences, and getting to travel and see all these places within the States and mix, you know, with the, you know, the people from out with the States as well. It was just an unbelievable experience.
Was it without bumps? I mean, if I remember my first exposure there, as we went across, which was 94 for the World Cup, and we bought a ticket. My wife and my brother and I, we just went for the fun of it. The differences in people's attitude or behaviour, not only from us, but across the States, you know, as you changed, was pretty radical. What did you see in terms of the society and the politics?
Very much how, as we said earlier, how similar the people were in terms of how easy it was to get on with them, the Americans in general, and how welcoming they were and how friendly they were, but also the differences. You know, the university was on one side of the tracks, you crossed the motorway, and then it was, you know, the black area. You know, that's basically how it was. There was an area of the city that was, you know, predominantly black, and that was just kind of how it worked. It was almost like there was a dividing line within the city of, you know, the sort of backgrounds of the people, the projects or whatever, you know, they wanted to call them. And, you know, that it was very, very different in terms of the actual culture. And when I was fortunate enough to travel, we'd go with friends in the holidays and drive.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd drive to Denver or we'd drive to spring break in Florida, and you'd go through wherever it may be, Alabama, and pull off our petrol, and you'd drive into some of these places and there'd be, you know, people walking around, you know, with no shoes on, and just the actual differences in what is normal for these people. It was mind-blowing, really, when you look back at
that. Yeah, I find that a lot to take in. I find it difficult to, because it is, you know, a giant mixing pot of ideas and wealth and poverty and discrimination and hope and ambition. It's I find it really hard to assimilate. And it's such a gigantic nation, too, which must be part of the cocktail of its attraction, but you know, it definitely leaves me stunned.
Yeah.
And also, there seem to be fewer people, I imagine, in the States that look upon that poverty or that division with shock or surprise than I feel would be the case in the country we were born in. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's the way it feels.
No, I think it is. I think that's genuinely the case. It's very much, you know, what they're used to and how, and they see it as being normal. But you arriving there and seeing it and, you know, trying to be involved in it was very... Yeah, it is a shock to the system, but you very quickly you adapt and it does become normal. And there's so many great things about it. You know, the extremes are, you know, this is fantastic to travel and what you see and how you're treated and stuff. And then you also look and you see the other side of things and you go, well, I'm not sure that can be right. But it is, there are such big extremes in the country. But overall, you know, it's such a fantastic experience. And I'm like you, you know, every time I go back and I look forward to the experiences, the cities, the people and the sport as well, you know, whereby they make it so attractive.
And then you come home and it's with a sense of, you know, this has been great for me and maybe I could have stayed in other circumstances. But you come home for what reason?
To play football. And I didn't come home thinking I wanted to stay. I came back thinking I'm ready to play football. You know, I'd had a degree of success. As a player, I was first team All-American, which was, you know, the best level that I could really be out there. So I had a bit of confidence in myself, you know, probably that I didn't have when I left.
Is that the biggest change?
Yeah, definitely. I'd not changed as a player. I was still the same player, but I just probably gained a little bit of confidence in myself and a belief that, you know, I could be a professional footballer. Mm. So came back with the aim of doing that. I'd written letters to English clubs, hoping for a trial. I'd got one arranged at Leeds United, probably one of the only clubs that go back to me.
Mm.
So I was looking forward to that. Came back home to Falkirk. In the meantime, my dad phoned Falkirk, unbeknown to me, saying, could David come in and trial or train before he went to trial? And Jim Jeffries, the manager at the time, says yes. So basically my dad threw me out of the house and... and at the training ground.
Once he got his son back, he was keeping him local. Yeah, never mind this Leeds stuff.
Yeah. And turned up at Falkirk, started training there, did pre-season. So I was in the dressing room with all the young lads. I was 22. I was in with the 16, 17-year-olds. which I loved. I enjoyed it and did a pre-season, played a couple of sort of bounce games, and I was offered a contract within probably 2 or 3 weeks.
Now, football's quite a sort of it's a school of hard knocks, but it's also full of dry and caustic humour. Were you dug out a little bit for being the American kid?
Of course. I mean, you come back and had 4 years in the States, pretty much, and your accent changes a little bit. You've got a few words that you probably shouldn't be saying, and you know what a dressing room's like at the best of times. So, and I, in my dressing room at the time,
who were they?
John Hughes, Ian McCall, you know, like lads who are
quiet, shy, retiring characters.
So, you know, it was a very mixed bag. I mean, through that Falkirk dressing room, Frank McAvaney, Morris Johnston, you know, like some real big characters and some really interesting people came through. So I was this young kid coming back from America, mixing with all these sort of people that I'd be watching on TV very, you know.
Did they make you prove yourself a little bit more than might have been the case if you'd, you know, gone through maybe a more traditional route?
Nah, they were great. Like, you know, the most important thing, I think, in any sort of dressing room is you're one of them, and I felt like I'd had 4 years of being one of them, you know, in a dressing room. So I and your football, obviously.
You knew. I know you. Yeah. You knew, and I think there's leadership in you. I think that's innate. I think not learned. So I suspected that you'd be able to cope with it, but I wondered if they'd maybe just taste you a little bit more to see if you were.
I think they always do, but I think I was confident enough in my football that I knew I'd be able to stand on 1-2 feet, and you were tested. You're constantly tested in football. That's the nature of it. You're tested every Saturday afternoon. You go over the white line. That's the, you know, that's the hard bit, really. You know, ultimately, that's the test when you get on the pitch and you've got to stand side by side by them.
I'm going to do this later on for somebody at Everton, but Morris Johnston, am I correct that he had a superb time when you were in the same team with him at Falkirk, that he was as alert and as classy as at the other stages of his career, and that he really excelled with you guys at that stage?
He did. I think it was a sort of Indian summer for Morris as well. He came back, you know, he'd been in England and probably hadn't gone the way he'd wanted to go, and he just came back and he enjoyed his football. You know, he was a big name, big profile, you know, a lot of attention around him, but as a fellow professional, he was outstanding. You know,
did that detract from his ability? It felt to me when I was watching him that the whole, particularly the Rangers-Celtic thing, stopped people from saying, look at his technique, look at his knowledge of what to do with the ball, look at the kicks he'll take, look at his goals record. I always thought he was a very, very good footballer.
He was, and that was the biggest shock, because he's a goal scorer, obviously, but he came to Falkirk, he was that little bit older, that little bit wiser, and he worked so hard in training every single day. And he ended up playing as a midfielder for Falkirk because he was such a good footballer.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just, you know, he genuinely was really impressive day in, day out, and in the games as well. And we had a really good season at Falkirk. I think we finished fourth in the league at the time, in the Premier League. You know, and he was a big part of that, allied to the others.
You'd gone back to right back then?
I was right back, centre back, kind of depending on who was available and who was playing, and you know.
Well, I suppose the obvious question is, how was it if your partner John? I have to ask you about John.
Yeah, he was inspirational, John. People often ask who was the best player you've played with, who was the best captain, who was the, you know, the best leader you've played with, and there's no leaders around, but he was, you know, very much a leader, very much somebody you'd want to follow in the dressing room. You know, he'd always chat to you during the game, before the game, he'd get you motivated, he'd get the team motivated, and, you know, he really was an impressive fella, and it's no surprise he's gone into management. It's probably a surprise the way he coached and the way he gets
his football values attract me. He loves to have the ball down, play it properly,
and he's got his beliefs, and you know, as a footballer, he was probably the opposite.
For those listening in England, he's also the man who took his clothes off and streaked in front of the BBC cameras at Parkhead, I think, which I think would have probably been one of his more mild escapades in general.
It was a character, and as I said, that dressing room was full of characters. You know, some of the people that were, you know, in and around that dressing room came and went, and it was a great, you know, learning experience as a footballer, and, you know, just these people that had been at some great clubs and round about great places, worked with great managers and played against and with some great players. So for me, as a football fan, turning up, I was walking around with my, you know, getting my eyes opened every day.
Is it a bit of a game changer in your life that, you know, you make it to the Scottish Cup final with Hearts and you win it. And, you know, the way that you get through the semi-final and who you beat in the final seems to me to have had quite a lot of repercussions for what happens to you in later life.
Yeah. It was, I mean, Hearts, again, Jim Jeffries moved on to Hearts, so I followed them there and he reinvigorated Hearts. Hearts were a bit of a sleeping giant. We became competitive in the league, you know, with Rangers and Celtic, as it was at the time, good Rangers and Celtic teams, and we were a really good Hearts team, and we genuinely thought we had a chance of winning the league, only to sort of fall short of the last hurdle.
Just, not and far that, short, eh?
And that was Hearts' modus operandi at the time. It was always falling at the last hurdle. So the cup final, after a couple of disappointments in previous cup finals, was expected to be pretty much more of the same. So actually win, obviously a massive relief to start with, because, you know, you don't want to be associated with that failure again. And the outpouring for the fans and the, you know, the city in general was incredible. You know, we obviously won it, celebrated, came back to Tynecastle, and then went into the city the next day on an open-top bus. And the amount of people, you know, driving down round Arthur's Seat and the Mound and, you know, along Princes Street, it was an unbelievable experience, the amount of people that came out to see Hearts finally winning the trophy after so long.
Was Arthur's Seat somewhere you knew quite well?
Yeah. Jim Jeffries used to have us running around there regularly and in pre-season, both with Falkirk and Hearts.
Around it or up it or what? Up
all over it. And but the abiding memory is, you know, finally finishing, coming down, Jim's car in the car park, making that last run, and he opens up the boot and there's a case of Tennent's Lager in the boot.
Oh, hey, that's proper man management. That's
exactly. He's great, Jim. He's very old school and very traditional, but, you know, great values. And it was always the case, right, you've got two runs left, you can do two doublers or you can do a treble, what do you want to do? So he always gave you the ownership, how you wanted to finish, what you want.
And for any outside Scotland who's listening, Arthur's Seat is a giant ex-volcano in the middle of Edinburgh. But I also want a wee bit more of the tension of Celtic Park that day, because your cup final's at Celtic Park, isn't it?
It was, yeah.
And so you beat Falkirk in the semi-final.
Falkirk in the semi-final, yeah. Which
they fluke one in to equalise, don't they?
Kevin McAllister. Uh-huh. Kevin was outstanding on the day. I just remember Kevin, a big Falkirk hero. And I, you know, growing up in Falkirk, obviously, the pressures that are associated with that playing in the game. I think I was captain of Hearts that game, and playing against your hometown team. So there was a lot of mixed emotions in the game. And it was at Ibrox that game as well. So it's funny how things work out. And eventually got through. Lucky to get through, to be honest.
Because he scores an absolute
scream. He scores an unbelievable goal. And he had an unbelievable game. I can remember Gary Naismith tells the story of Jim Jeffries having him pinned up against the wall in the dressing room at halftime because of how much fun Kevin McAllister was having in that game, and, you know, try to explain to Gary what he needed to do to stop that. But Kevin was unplayable.
In firm terms.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Kevin was unplayable and, you know, scored an unbelievable goal and carried Falkirk, really. And they deservedly probably should have got through at the final.
But you guys get two goals in 4 minutes and win 3-1. But it's a tense game. It's Walter Smith's last game for Rangers, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, it was. And that team, you know, that
let's name them
together. There was McCoist, there was Loudrop, Goff, you know, I hope I'm not getting any of these wrong.
Gorham and goals,
yeah. So there, you know, it was a creme de la creme, the 9-in-a-row Rangers team. And Walter was leaving, sacked, as he says, but
now, this, he doesn't say that, does he?
Yeah, he does, yeah.
At this stage you don't know him, do you?
Not really, only from,
because he's going to be a very big character in your life.
And he tried to sign me a couple of times that I learned subsequently from Falkirk and from Hearts. You know, as time goes on, obviously you find these stories, but at the time I didn't know him well. No, obviously I have a great admiration for him because I'd grown up as a Rangers supporter and followed that team, went and watched that team and, you know, supported that team. So obviously had an affection for him and the team, but didn't know him well enough at that time or at all, really.
And if I remember my match right, there's a small penalty incident towards the end of the
Well, it's actually 20 years.
Now, I'm a great fan of referees, so I think the referee called it right, but you may have a different view. I don't know. You
no, I'm
talk us through the minute by minute, play by play.
Well, it's very late in the game. We Stevie Fulton actually scored, I think, before 3 o'clock. That was the sort of claim to fame. You know, we had a penalty and scored before 3 o'clock had even come round, so it was a great start to the game. we scored again early in the second half. Stephen Adam, a great French player, had done really well for Hearts, scored in the game. Rangers come back into it. McCoy enters the fray as usual, scores, and then late on in the game, Rangers are attacking, as you can imagine, trying to rescue the game, and a clash between McCoist and Weir on the edge of the box.
This is very good.
Willie Young, the referee, very good friend of mine, subsequently.
And on the day.
It's outside the box.
But it definitely was.
It was outside the box, I'm convinced it was. And Coist will tell you a different story. But they got a free kick on the edge of the box, not a penalty. It comes to nothing. And we won the cup.
Which, from, you know, from, I guess on that night you don't think about having been a striker in Indiana or, you know, your dad phoning Jim Jeffries up. But, you know, what's that moment like from lifting the cup forward until, you know, you go to bed that night? What happens? Madness? Friends and family first?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that the coach, or my coach in the States, was at that game, so he came to the game, so he was there, so that was quite nice in terms of,
fabulous,
you know, the kind of the symmetry of that. So he was actually at the game, so you do obviously interact with
your invitation
friend. Yes, yeah,
in fantastic
fact, he came over and he watched the game, and that was great, you know, to kind of do that. And then we were on a bus after the game heading, but it's 20 years actually 20 years this year, and we're having a reunion now in a couple of weeks actually, for the game. So we've got a bus back to Tynecastle to have a reception at the stadium, and coming along Gorgie Road, you'll know Gorgie Road. Coming along Gorgie Road, the boys had obviously had a couple of beers, as you do, and the fans again were starting to crowd the streets, and the bus came to a stop. You know, it basically couldn't move along Gorgie Road, probably half a mile from the stadium, and some of the lads started getting out on the through the sunroofs and on the top of the bus as the bus was driving in. So it was really surreal when you think back to what actually went on, and, you know, probably not things you'd be able to do these days or get up to these days, but
I thoroughly approve.
There's actually some good TV footage. I think the lads came back, and I think it was Hazel Irvine and Chick Young, Scottish reporters, interviewing the lads as they came off the bus and some of the states that they encountered when they came off.
One or two shandies had been had.
One or two shandies were taken on that.
Hopefully you enjoyed that big interview, which was first released as an exclusive to our socios 12 months ago. If you'd like to get these interviews on the first day that they're available, it's time for you to join us, to become a socio. And for only £2.99 a month, you will get an exclusive big interview plus regular mini documentaries, not only all ad-free, but all featuring me and bringing you interesting, funny, and sometimes scandalous things from Spanish football. Go to patreon.com/Graham Hunter to unlock our entire archive. That means that once you join, you will have a treasure trove of interviews with funny, elite, interesting, revelatory top-class footballers. By joining us, you will help support this independent podcast. You will help to keep us on the road interviewing people and sending that content for your delectation. If you go to the gym, you'll be slimmer. If you've got a dog, he or she will thank you. If you've got a TV, you can turn it off and listen to this instead.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.